Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. We're on a search for entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join us on tonight's episode when my guest JP reveals his method for overcoming a monster that had been haunting him for years.
It's sort of like the monster I have to beat, and I can beat it by tackling it and writing about it.
The topic is Final Fantasy VII and Hola Papi. How do you forgive someone who can't or won't apologize? My guest this week is J.P. Brammer, who dispenses advice in the column Hola Papi on Grindr's news site Into. J.P.'s made a name for himself by providing thoughtful insights into living your best gay life. But his understanding of life and love didn't just spring into existence fully formed. It's the product of some pain, some forgiveness, and a college club that he really hoped would present more opportunities for making out. Thanks to everyone who makes the Sewers of Paris possible with a pledge of a dollar or more a month on Patreon. There are special rewards for patrons like early ad-free access to content, shoutouts and videos, and a copy of my book mailed to you with some cute Sewers of Paris buttons. If you're enjoying the show, head over to sewersofparis.com and click support the show on Patreon. Or if you can't pledge, you can still help out by leaving a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you're in San Francisco, I'll be in town to host a live show featuring drag queens playing Dungeons & Dragons. It's on March 20th at Oasis and features Erica Clash from Dragula, Kitty Powers of the game's Matchmaker and Love Life, San Francisco stars Poya Del Mar and Kai Kai B. Michaels, and past Sewers guest Pup Amp, the scantily clad co-host of the YouTube series What's the Safe Word. Tickets are now on sale. Head over to dungeondrag.com for the link. And if you're not in San Francisco, please pass the word along to someone who you think might enjoy the show. Also, I'm about to launch a brand new podcast featuring drag queens playing D&D. It's called Queens of Adventure, and we're crowdfunding through the month of March to pay for performers, music, art, and equipment. Visit queensofadventure.com to join us in bringing this new podcast to life. You can find links to all these projects and also clips of the entertainment we talked about on this week's episode at sewersofparis.com. Now, here's JP. Well, this week I'm speaking to writer Jean-Paul Brammer. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, what is the entertainment that changed your life?
So, when I was asked what to pick, I kind of went on instinct, and the first thing that popped into my head was Final Fantasy VII. And that's a game that was released by Square Enix on PlayStation. It's a role-playing game in 1997. It follows this mercenary who's part of this eco-terrorist organization who's trying to stop a mega-corporation called Shinra from using the planet's life essence as an energy source. They're essentially trying to use the planet's natural spirit as a way to make money and as a way to build profit. And there's an alien involved that comes crashing down to Earth that leaves this giant crater. And the main antagonist sort of stops becoming... it's no longer Shinra, it becomes Sephiroth, who's one of the most iconic villains of all time. Anyone who's played any Square Enix game probably knows Sephiroth. If you've played Kingdom Hearts, you know Sephiroth. He's the long, silver-haired baddie with the giant frickin' sword.
The Life Stream. That's what we call the river of life that circles our planet. Giving life to the world and everything in it. The Shinra Electric Power Company discovered a way to use the life stream as an energy source. Because of Shinra's energy, we were able to live very comfortable lives. But wasn't that because we were taking away from the planet's life? A lot of people thought so.
And everything that sort of unfolds from all this, you slowly build a team of people, you get to know their backstories... they're all trying to work together towards this common goal of saving the planet. Like I said, there's so much to this story for me to get into. There's so many different details and little side quests that I could talk about, but I'd say that's the bare essentials.
So I'm delighted to hear you say that because we've actually, the show has gotten requests for more Final Fantasy episodes.
Oh, really?
From listener Jeremy has been asking for more Final Fantasy VII. So
here it is.
Tell me, for some reason that one... I think really resonates. I mean, it's just such a good one, but I think it really resonates particularly with queer people. And I'm not 100% sure why that is. Did you play it when it initially came out?
Yeah. So it is actually the first game I've ever played and beaten video game wise. I also played it with my dad like not too long after it came out. So it was sort of our little group project. And the way that I remember this game, I was sort of debating before doing the show if I even wanted to review it too much because it exists in my memory as this really magical, wild, unexplainable thing. And I kind of thought that going back sort of taking another look at the plot, taking a look at what actually happened there would almost make me more distant from it, from what I've come to know it as. But curiosity got the better of me, and I started looking at it again. And upon further review, I think I can easily see why queer people, including myself, found so much resonance in it.
Whose idea was it to play it with your dad?
I assume it was my dad's idea, which is weird because, I definitely love my dad, but he was definitely one of those, like, business trip type dads that would just go away for 9 days and I wouldn't see him. And, he was very aloof, very, distant when I was a kid. We didn't do much of anything together. Like, we every once in a while we would play sports together, and that was never something I was super into, and conversation never really came easy between us, but it's sort of so strange to me now, looking back, that we played a game together. Not just a game, but one as, like, wild as Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah, so what was it like to suddenly have him? Like, I assume this was a big time investment, so you must have spent a lot of time together.
We did spend a lot of time together, and interestingly enough, so I'm a writer, I'm a storyteller. My dad is not a writer, and not really much of a storyteller either, but he was in that role of storyteller for me back then, because there were some things he didn't want me to see or some things that he thought were inappropriate, so he would have to then explain the story to me. Or, you know, there were some themes or some parts of that story that were too complicated for a fourth grader, which I was at the time, to really understand, I guess. So he would sort of break it down and start talking about why Sephiroth was doing this, why Cloud Strife was doing that, why there are monsters popping up. And he's never really been in that role before or since to me, which is why it just really amplifies what this game is to me, because my dad is not a person who should really be explaining evil energy monsters that have been created by a fictional corporation, but that's what he was doing.
In his explanations, is that something that formed the way that you were seeing the world? Because, like, fourth grade is kind of the time when you start to, it's around the time, the age that you start to figure out, like, what good and bad is and how the world works.
Yeah, so what's interesting about my dad is, so back then, he was still very much a Republican. He's not so much a conservative anymore. But if you've never heard, like, a country-ish Oklahoma white guy explain what Mako energy is and explain what, like, Eris, who is one of the characters, why she had to die to join the life stream. These are all things that he was explaining to me in his voice, and it was so out of character for him. And yeah, I think that it did have an impact on how I saw entertainment and how I saw fiction, because my dad was such a practical, everyday, down-to-earth type person, but his willingness to sort of engage in this crazy fantasy world sort of told me in a way that it was okay. Because I think back then, your dad is the person, especially if you're a young boy, is the gatekeeper of what is okay and what's not okay, right? Like, if your dad says that you can't wear this, you can't wear that, stop being a sissy, stop doing, like, art, or stop caring about clothes, that's something that a lot of boys take in at that age, and they say, okay, I'm not going to do that anymore. So I think it was so pivotal for me that my father played this role of storyteller and collaborator in this really creative, expansive universe where, and Final Fantasy is a game that just does not care about hewing close to reality. It will go balls to the wall. There are robots, dragons, magic, summoning, space elements, ships to fly on, guns. Like, it throws the whole kitchen sink at it. And I think that someone like my dad, who's a businessman, engaging in that world with me, let me know, okay, this is a real, tangible element of this world, creativity and storytelling. And I think that sort of was pivotal for me.
Having your dad kind of give you permission to have more imagination and engage with the fantasy, what did that change? Like, after playing the game, did you find yourself with different interests or maybe free to explore interests that you weren't before?
So I remember being very obsessed with this game. I don't want to say that it knowingly put queer elements into the game. I don't know if that necessarily translates from one culture to another, but I do remember there was a scene where, at the very beginning, Cloud Strife, the first playable character, has to dress up in drag in order to infiltrate this sort of compound, and he has the mob boss who's selecting wives at that time chooses him without knowing that he's, you know, a man. And that was, like, such a weird thing to witness at that age, because, you know, I didn't really know I was gay at the time. I knew I was hiding something, and I knew that something was different about me, but just seeing that, I was like, huh, that's weird. And my dad didn't really try to explain that one to me. He was just like, oh, yeah, whatever. But,
well, I mean, surely he wasn't like, oh, yeah, whatever. Like, what was he, like, do you remember what his
childhood was like at that time? When my dad doesn't want to talk about something, he just gets very, like, stone-faced, and he quickly passes through it, like, kind of skips over a bunch of stuff. And I always knew when not to bring something up with my dad, and that was one of those things, so I just didn't mention it. But I remember witnessing it in a sort of gay silence.
I'm sure, like, at the time you weren't even aware that it was a gay silence, but was right. there something there that you were like, I don't know why this is interesting to me?
Yeah, it was definitely that. And, you know, my dad nowadays is extremely accepting of me and couldn't be prouder of me, but I do remember being young and every once in a while something would come up on TV, like two guys kissing or something, and he would make this ugh type expression, and he would make little gestures to let me know that he thought that was gross. And I remember being a little bit scared, and I couldn't explain why I was scared when that popped up, because it wasn't at a time where I thought something even marginally related to me is happening on screen right now. It's a video game. I didn't have a desire to dress in drag or anything, but I had that same fear that he was gonna make a weird gesture or a weird noise, and I just remember being relieved when he didn't, and it just sort of passed.
Well, it passed in the game, but it didn't pass in your life.
Correct. Correct.
When was the next time that something like that came up in the family?
It's so, like, my family dynamics, it's hard to really explain. Like, my mom is sort of the one who's strong-willed, and she's sort of the one who sets the moral tone of everything. So it's sort of like when she's okay with something, or when she's accepted something, that's just how it is. So she was sort of the one that I was always more concerned about accepting me. She comes from, like, a Mexican background, Catholic, but a half-hearted Catholic, where okay. She didn't really want to go to church that much. And when we did, we would always sit in the very back pew so that we could leave early and, quote-unquote, beat the church people to, like, Golden Corral or lunch or whatever. So she was sort of the one that I was like, yeah, if my mom accepts me, that's just everyone's going to accept me in the family. So with my dad, it's really – I really don't remember. I just remember it being scattered through the whole time that I was living at home back when I was younger, these little moments that would pop up where he would just make it kind of known that he didn't really approve of what he was seeing. But then right after I came out, it just completely changed.
Do you credit your mother with that?
I think my dad is super smart. He has a gay brother himself, and he's just like, how do I even explain him? He's just so incredibly intelligent. I can't see him actually caring about gay people existing. I think that was just something he was acting out because he felt it was expected of him, but he's just such a apathetic in a good way person where it almost feels like my dad is this alien observer to humanity. And he's just sort of like acting out things that he thinks that guys are supposed to do. But in reality, he's a little bit too smart for all that. And I don't think he really cares. But yeah, like my mom was the one to give the emphatic emotional, yes, we accept you. And from then on, it just was never a thing.
How did that happen? Like, was there a particular, like, specific, yes, we accept you moment?
Yeah, actually, I came out so late because I grew up in a very rural community in Oklahoma, in the middle of nowhere, and I was bullied really badly in middle school to the point where I had to be transferred over to a high school that was pretty far away from where we lived, but it's where my mom taught English, and I had to kind of go there to start over again because things got so bad, and I didn't come out for a really long time because of that, not because I was afraid of my parents, but because I was afraid of my immediate surroundings. And I went to college at the University of Oklahoma, and it wasn't until my junior year that I came out to my parents when they were, like, getting me settled in my new apartment. They were kind of helping me out because they only lived an hour and a half away or so. And my sister was coming to the University of Oklahoma for the first time, and my mom was saying something like, you need to protect her from frat boys because you don't know how they are and stuff like that. And I don't know why I took that as a perfect segue, but I was like, oh, I also like boys. And they were, it almost felt like they were waiting to jump on the moment where I actually said it, because it was so immediate. My mom was like, oh, of course, we love you and we accept you. And my dad was like, yeah, that's right, like, retweet or whatever.
Do you think they might have rehearsed that moment before you said it?
I think they've been rehearsing it since middle school. Yeah, definitely. I think they've known for, they knew a really long time.
You know, I hear from a lot of queer people that we have this, like, idea, like, oh, my deep, dark secret that I've managed to keep from the world. And the world is like, yeah?
Yeah, no shit. Yeah. My mom for sure knew, probably since I was really little. You know that fucking Macklemore song where it's like, I knew I was gay because I could draw in the third grade? It was like that. Where, like, I was really into art, and I liked drawing, and I liked things that weren't considered traditionally masculine. And I think from that, she was just able to derive, like, yeah, my son is gay. I had a girlfriend in high school, which is kind of funny now that I look back on it. I always thought my mom just really hated her, but I think a big part of her was always like, why is he doing this? This isn't like who he is.
What kind of art and drawing did you do?
It was mostly just like fantasy things. I've always been very averse to drawing people. And I've always been very averse to people in general. I remember as a kid, like, really, really young, I didn't want any toys that were human beings. I didn't want any action figures that were superheroes. I didn't want, like Batman couldn't stand him, Superman couldn't stand him. All the male Disney characters that were, like, princes or whatever, I hated them. So I only drew, like, wolves and dragons and creatures and kind of just these really abstract. I remember my Catholic school, because I went to Catholic school for the first, like, 6 years of my life, described them as, like, demons and called my mom in to be like, he's drawing demons, because they had, like, bat wings, or they had, like, they were reptile-looking, but they had fur. Stuff like that is the things I enjoy drawing.
So, previously, I had Johnny Jungle Guts on as a guest, and we talked about Final Fantasy VII, particularly character Red 13.
Yes, I was going to bring him up.
So, tell me about what you remember about that character.
He was my absolute favorite character. He was the one that I always wanted on the party, and the one that I always, like, gave all the best boosts to, the one whose limit break I always used. Just because, yeah, he wasn't a human being. And I found those, for some reason, way more approachable as a kid, because I was just really terrified of other people.
How do you describe him for somebody who hasn't played the game?
Sure. So Red 13 is sort of what you would imagine a hybrid between, like, a big cat and a wolf would be. So he's tiger-like. He doesn't have stripes. He's completely red. He wears feathers. He can talk. He can do magic, and he's from a tribe that was meant to protect this village, but then his tribe got completely wiped out by this warring clan. He thought that his father was a coward because he thought that his father abandoned the village in their moment of need, but it turns out he was sort of the last man standing between this enemy clan and the village, and he was pierced with these, like, poisonous arrows that turned him into stone. It's very, like, Greek, almost, in that sort of mythological, tragic way. But yeah, he's just an all-around badass, talking tiger thing.
I don't know why it is, but Red 13 really seems to speak to a lot of queer people that I've spoken to about that game. And I wonder if it's just purely, like, his outsider status. I mean, down to his species, but, like, an outsider in that he's the only one of his kind?
So I think it's all those things. Like, the thing about Red 13 is he's at first extremely underestimated, because when he first opens his mouth, all the humans are like, he can talk? and he's sort of seen as this weird anomaly that they can't really comprehend. His clothing is definitely femish. I mean, he doesn't wear anything, but he wears jewelry. He has this sort of flair to him that's very extra sort of thing. And what's really cool about Red 13 is that he uses his rage as his magic. One of his limit breaks is that he can summon this, like, red moon type thing, and his attack goes way up, and he sort of channels all his anger into it. And I think that his narrative sort of speaks to that sort of outsider turning your rage into a sort of action. And he's just very, yeah, he's the last surviving member of his clan, and he doesn't have anyone he can speak to. He doesn't have anyone who understands where he comes from or who he is. And it's sort of that isolating thing that I think drew me to him.
Did you feel like you had rage that was escalating in a meter somewhere?
Oh, God, yeah. I think I still do. I think I did when I was a kid. It was nameless and I didn't understand it, but it was happening. Which is the strange thing about queerness to me. It's like now that I'm cognizant of it and now that I've studied it for so long, I kind of can identify where certain things are coming from. But when you're at that age, it's still acting on you. It's just you haven't excavated it and you haven't studied it. So yeah, like that was definitely an element that was happening in my youth. And sometimes I would just get really angry and not know why.
Yeah, yeah. You feel that frustration, but you don't even know like what's frustrating you.
Yeah, like where is it coming from? Why do you have it? It's almost like you have to find the origin story, you know?
Yeah, that's a really good way to look at it. And it doesn't seem to make sense because, like, when you're looking at a character in a story, you know, you can look back in their past and learn about where they came from and figure out, like, oh, that's why they're that way. But yeah. You know where you came from. And so, I don't know, there's this feeling of, like, well, I came from the same place as all these other people. Why do I feel this way that's different?
Yeah, well, when you look at all these games that sort of rely on a hero's journey or something, it always tends to be the main character's going on about their life, everything's normal, something disrupts it, and they have to suddenly confront who they've been all along, but they just weren't aware that's who they were. So if you take, like, The Legend of Zelda, for example, Link is usually just trying to live his ho-hum life in his little shack or whatever, and then he's told, by the way, you're the hero of time, and here's what you have to do. And I think that queerness can be like that in that it comes out of nowhere. Like, you've always been this. You maybe always knew in the back of your head, but now you have to actually adventure out and discover it. And that's so closely related to the RPG experience in a kind of funny way.
Yeah, so tell me about your venturing out. It sounds like going to college was beneficial in your coming out process. Was that like a place where you could be out? Like, I think you said it was the University of Oklahoma, which I imagine was still maybe not the most welcoming.
Yeah, I mean, it was very up and down. I think I probably should have gone to school somewhere else. It would have helped me out quite a bit. Just to get away from that state in general. Like, there were certainly instances of bigotry, and it was a lot easier, for example, to be gay than to be trans. But at the same time, in my head, I was like, this is still Oklahoma. And so all those things that were keeping me in the closet because I lived in a rural community, I kind of brought with me because in my head, I hadn't gone anywhere. So I spent 2 years in the University of Oklahoma without coming out. And it wasn't until my junior year that I did. And I still didn't feel like super connected to anything.
What made that the right time to at least start coming out?
It was just a tipping point. I mean, I think I was seeing but not seeing one of my best friends from high school who I was really in love with, and I couldn't seem to let him go because we had found this awkward middle place where I wasn't out and he wasn't out, but we would mess around together. But he would still try to date girls, but I was definitely in love with him, and it was really painful for me. That went on the end of my freshman year and my entire sophomore year. And at some point it was like, okay, you can either keep suffering like this or you can come out. And it took that for me because I think I'm so stubborn. And once I get in my habit, once I get in my way of thinking, I am deeply entrenched in it. So I had gone through all this trouble to pretend to be straight all this time. And while I was in the closet, I hardly ventured out into even looking at, like, gay porn or messing around with other guys. Like, I completely isolated myself from that. So it took something sort of earth-shattering for me to come out in the first place, and that's what it was.
It was that relationship that was, it sounds like it was dysfunctional in on both sides.
Yeah, absolutely.
What happened when you came out? Like, did that make things better with at least with that relationship, or did that complicate things?
I came out and, you know, a bunch of options finally opened up. I was like, oh, I don't feel like I have to be with this guy. This guy is not everything. There will be other people. So that was good. And then I could finally let him go. And I feel like I changed so quickly that the context between me and him became so different so quickly that within a few months, I felt like we were on different planets. I really did. As far as like my overall happiness, no, I think it got worse before it got better. Because then all of a sudden I was like, I need to hook up with a bunch of people. I need to make a bunch of gay friends. I need, like, all this pressure suddenly mounting on me, and I put it on a person who just wasn't ready for all that. And I think it was definitely trial by fire for probably a year.
Where were you learning what it is to be a gay person? Like, what made you think, like, this is the right way to do this?
You know, I really didn't have too many leads. I didn't know of any, like, gay media, gay resources, any of that. I was winging it, basically. And I think that probably the most instrumental thing for me back then was this really shady website, or CD, I guess I should say, called Adam for Adam. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So I started, like, hooking up with guys through that and meeting certain people through that. And I think that was where I got all my information from, was from hookups and dates. And I would just start piecing together things that way.
Not always the best way to form a portrait of the community, but I mean, at least you were like going out and looking.
Yeah, I think that my instincts went there, and that's just where I followed it. I tried to join, what's it called, like an LGBTQ student club on the university, but at that time I saw it almost completely through the lens of sex and sexual desire, and I found it difficult to access the more important part, which is the education. I saw it like, okay, people are meeting each other here to, you know, date or to hook up, and that's really not what it was, of course, but that's where my mind was for some reason back then.
Well, I think, you know, we have a hierarchy of needs, right? And,
right.
And when that one's finally, when that one's being fulfilled, that's when you can turn your attention to community and causes.
Yes.
But it's hard to focus on that stuff when you're like, ah, I just need to land in bed with somebody.
Exactly. Yeah, that's where I was.
So when did things start to actually get better?
When did they get better? I mean, it hasn't been a straight climb, a steady climb from bad to good. It's sort of gone up and down quite a bit since then. As far as like being at peace with my sexuality, though, and being okay with it, it was actually through writing. I started actually writing on these subjects, reading on these things, expressing myself more. And that was when, because I see my writing as it's something I've always wanted to do, it's something I've always done to the point where it feels like a third arm to me. It's not something I willingly chose and not something I really thought to go out of my way to become a writer. It's always been this movable extension of me. And once gayness got into that, that's how it got assimilated into the rest of me, to a point where I was like, oh, now I get it. The light turned on.
Well, so what were you writing previously, and what changed once you started gaying it up?
Sure. I was mostly just writing essays in high school. I won a bunch of essay contests on like a national, international level, and that's where it was mostly just, you know, student essay fodder. Like, write a memory that was really important to you, or what does freedom mean to you, or things like that. But I would also write short stories, and I would write sci-fi things on my spare time. And when gayness finally came into my life, or when I finally accepted it, it sort of opened up this new world of things to think about, things to consider, because I had never considered myself a sexual being until then, and I had never considered myself part of a community of any kind. I mean, sure, I was like Latino, but Latino in rural Oklahoma, not necessarily part of a community. Suddenly I found all these issues that people were having, like homelessness or STDs or dating issues or this different form of love that I wasn't familiar with. And all these things opened up inspirations for me. And I started writing essays about that, articles, short stories, etc. And that was sort of the carrot on the stick that kept leading me more and more into this world of gayness, to the point where I finally arrived somewhere where I just understood it, I think.
You mentioned that when you were younger, you would draw a lot of like fantasy stuff, and yeah, like your interest was definitely in like non-human characters. Did you find that that was like in the fiction that you were writing? Did that continue?
Not necessarily, just because I love writing about emotions, and I kind of had to write about human beings if I wanted to write about emotions. It didn't necessarily translate there. I don't know why. I wrestle a lot with why I was so deeply terrified of human beings for so long. And I think it was just, you know, social anxiety mental issues that I didn't really understand, a fear of being abused just because I was pretty much bullied from day one in the school system up until high school. And I think it just made me innately afraid of what people were going to do to me. And so when I escaped to that fantasy world, I preferred to just not even factor them in.
Yeah, I mean, like, the way you're describing it, I mean, I can't imagine why you wanted to disassociate yourself from human interactions during yeah. that time.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you really integrated, like, once you became more comfortable being gay and talking about gay issues, you became more comfortable just talking about people in general. Like, were you yeah. finally, like, did you leave the university and go someplace where you had more gay culture and people in your life?
So after I graduated, I spent a brief period of time studying abroad in Barcelona, where actually a lot of these old issues that I had in middle school came back up, because what I found was the people who want to study abroad in Barcelona want to do it for the beach, and they want to do it to party. So I ended up with a lot of fratty types and sorority types, and those are people that I hadn't interacted with on campus on purpose anyway. Mm-hmm. And I found myself the outsider again, like the kind of nerdy, quiet, reclusive type person, and it put me back in those old shoes. And so I sort of walled myself off again for a while. And then once I got back from Barcelona, I didn't know what to do with my life, because writing jobs are hard to come by. So I started working at a bookstore in Oklahoma mm-hmm. City, just sort of, and in that time, I thought, okay, I really have to get out of this state because it's done nothing but bad for me. And so in between working at the bookstore, I would sit myself down at coffee shops and just say, okay, write until you get better. And I think I wrote every day for a whole year for like several hours. And finally,
what were you writing?
I was trying to get more involved in anything that could get me to move. So that was like writing for media outlets, writing about LGBT issues, writing about Latino issues, just looking for any little thing that would get me published somewhere so that the right person could read it.
Were there particular moments where you got something placed somewhere that was meaningful to you?
Yeah. After a few months of, because it wasn't an organized thing at all. It was basically throw yourself against the wall until you can climb it. And I finally got published in, the very first place I ever got published was this place called This Land Press, which is a local kind of literary bent newspaper in Oklahoma. And I wrote about what happened to me in middle school with the bullying. And people read it, and I got such a great response to it. Like, oh, this is beautifully written. You did such a good job, etc. And that felt really good. So I was like, okay, I can keep writing. This is going somewhere finally.
Did it feel cathartic to not only get that out into the world, but also to have turned it into something positive, like telling the experience to other people, make it something that benefited you?
Yeah, I think that was the first sort of moment I realized that telling my story could actually, I don't know, impact someone else for completely different but similar reasons. I mean, they didn't have my same experience, but they felt something. And that put me on a track for the kind of writing I wanted to do. After that, it was like I got published in The Advocate. I started writing for a Huffington Post, and that's where my first boss found me and moved me to DC. I'm one of those people who I'm very willing for my writing to go into the weeds, to go to uncomfortable, frightening places in my mind if it means that the writing ends up better. I know some people don't feel like they can write about something until they're fully over it or they've fully processed it, but for me, it's sort of like the monster I have to beat, and I can beat it by tackling it and writing about it. So the writing itself is the arena for me dealing with it. It's not like when I'm writing something, it's said and done, I've accepted it, and I understand how to synthesize it into something. It's the opposite for me.
What are the bosses that you were fighting through the words that you were putting on the page?
For the very first one, what I went through in middle school with the bullying, which it was this very like next level type of bullying involving like physical violence and the principal and the teachers not doing anything, and in some cases joining in on it in this very isolated school in the middle of nowhere where everyone in all the grades could fit into one little gym. So it was just like, it was definitely pure hell for me, and it was something that I wasn't sure I was going to make it out of, and I was definitely suffering from suicidal ideation over, and there was definitely several points where I thought, maybe I'm not going to make it through this. And when I sat down to finally write about that, I was still at a place where just talking about it still made me shake and still made me feel sick. And I guess I just kept saying, you have to push through it. You just have to keep pushing through it. And I knew that writing it and publishing it would probably bring a lot of those characters back into my life. And it did. I mean, there were a couple people who were hostile to it and reached out to me in a hostile way after it came out. But that felt like something I had to do. And I think I was right.
How did you respond to them getting back into your life?
I just told myself, respond in a way that you can be proud of and in a way that it's going to put it all behind you. And I acted like my idea of a person who was stronger than that. I didn't feel stronger than what was happening in that time. I didn't feel strong enough to really be like, I'm sorry you feel that way. It's in the past, and this is something that I have the right to talk about, and I wish you well, but this is how it is. That, to me, would be the response of grace, and that's not the response I wanted to give, but just by pretending I was that person, I was able to give it, and that's how I handled it.
Did that get you to a point where suddenly you weren't shaking and feeling sick when you thought about it anymore?
Yeah, like, even now, I don't feel terror. I don't feel any fear or sickness or anything, because it feels like it's in a world that's different from mine now, in a world that's very far away from me. And that was the liminal experience, I guess, where once I said it's behind me now and I've written about it and it was almost like all those years I was waiting for it to come back. Like, I knew it would come back at some point. And I thought it's going to talk to you again, and it's going to have a face again, and it's going to be right in front of you again. And then when it was, I didn't have that feeling in the back of my head anymore. I didn't have that instinct, it's going to come back. I just thought, it's over. And yeah, it helped me get over it.
What you're describing reminds me a lot of the end of Labyrinth, when Sarah finally remembers the words, you have no power over me.
Yeah, it's exactly like that, I think.
So it sounds like you had this sort of hidden superpower that you didn't realize you had until you started using it.
Yeah, I think that a lot of queer people do. I think it's forgiveness, but forgiveness sort of implies this passive thing, or it implies this, I'm over it, or I forgive you and therefore we're fine. I think that forgiveness can be not necessarily a weapon, but something you use to empower yourself with. It's not necessarily about redeeming the other person. It's about you sealing away the evil where it can't hurt you anymore. And I think that's something that a lot of queer people have to sort of get to know and practice if they're going to live their lives, basically.
Yeah, you know, this was something that I was talking to somebody recently about, is when you are enduring some sort of trauma, there's one approach, which is to put up a lot of armor and to try to shield yourself, which also limits your ability to move and interact with the world.
Yeah.
And then another approach is to endure whatever that trauma is and, you know, think of it as not the story doesn't end with you being attacked by something. The story ends with how you overcome it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that right now where we're at, we've sort of stigmatized or at least cast forgiveness in this really bad light. Like, we're living in a time where all these horrible things are happening. And I remember right after the election, for example, it was all about, like, how do we work with for the Trump voters and how do we forgive them and stuff like that. And it was sort of seen as this, now is not the time for forgiveness. Now is the time for fighting and stuff like that. But I think forgiveness is part and parcel to fighting, because if I'm too heavy and I'm still suffering from something, it inhibits my ability to move on. It inhibits my ability to keep fighting and be sort of this person I need to be if I'm going to make it through this life. And practicing it in a way that makes me feel like it's not weakness, or like in a way that makes me feel like I'm not giving something up, has been so crucial to my mental well-being in this moment we're in.
Yeah, and practice is really the right word, because it takes work. Something that you have to really cultivate.
Absolutely. And sort of like, just to bring it back to Final Fantasy VII, now that I'm just thinking about it, you know who it was a great sort of metaphor for this was Aeris, the person who, I don't know how familiar you are with the game, but she sort of sacrifices herself in order to save the whole planet, because the planet is smothering itself with its own healing powers. there's this life force, and the life force is gathering around the wounds, because in order for the wounds to heal, it needs to create this surplus of energy. But because there's this clot in it, it's basically smothering itself to death in its own energy that's supposed to be making it better. And she sort of has to be the conduit to give herself up if that's going to unclot itself and everything flows back to normal and everything is restored. I think that that game actually places a really high priority on healing, which is so fascinating for a game with all these like swords and guns and weapons. It's like at the end of the day, the thing that saves the world is healing magic. And that was really resonant to me.
So once you figured out that you were a healer, for yourself, did you continue writing about your own experiences and what kind of stuff were you writing?
So it's funny. I actually think of my writing as medicine in a way. Like right now, one of my big jobs is as an advice columnist at intomore.com. It's sort of produced by Grindr of all places. But I get these letters from people around the world talking about the things they're dealing with and sort of their issues, and I don't feel like I can love again. I'll never get over my ex. I'm still carrying around all this bitterness over something that happened to me when I was younger, and they sort of come from all over the world, and I really have to consider before I submit a response, is this response medicine of some kind? Is it going to provide healing of some kind, or is this just self-service? And I never want to see my writing as self-service. I want it to serve some kind of better purpose of making someone else feel better, or at least feel like they understand themselves more.
Well, we've really integrated those two aspects. I mean, with the outlet that you're writing for, it's so different from the experience that you had in college where it was like, oh, this is a organizing group, but I'm also really interested in the hookups. Here you have a hookup app that is also providing some sort of medicine, some sort of healing to people. Yeah. So you're finally bringing those two things together in a way that's
honest. Never thought of it that way, but you're right.
Well, there you go. You did it.
I did it right. It's done. Yes. Very good.
So tell me about like the advice that you're giving now. Letters that were particularly meaningful to you, or is there advice that you gave that you were really proud of?
I can honestly say I've read all of them. I definitely look at each and every one of them, and some of them I don't answer just because I'll get some, for example, that are from India or from Nigeria, and they're like, if I come out, my family might completely disown me or I might be killed, but this guy is sort of giving me vibes what I do, and I'm just like, I'm not going to be the person that gives you advice that could get you killed. Like, I'm not going to put that on me. But yeah, I've had some where I'm really proud of the advice I've given. I had someone ask me, do I believe in true love or not? Because this person was questioning if he's ever going to find his soulmate. I was really proud of the way I handled that one because I think you don't have to believe in soulmates to believe in true love. I think that true love doesn't have to be forever in order for it to be valid. True love could last a few years, it could last a decade, it could last a few months. But at the end of the day, you have to lose absolutely everything. That's just sort of how life works. And sort of being able to encapsulate what sounds like a really morbid concept, which is the inevitability of loss and death, while also celebrating the good stuff that happens in between. I think I was able to handle that pretty well for a letter that would eventually be distributed on Grindr.
Have you encountered true love?
Yeah, I think I have. Actually, I know I have. I've definitely felt something really strong and powerful for some people. Hasn't always ended very well. And that's sort of what my letter was about. I just told the story of this one guy that I loved very deeply who, because of circumstances out of both of our hands, it just didn't work out. But I have true love in my life right now. I mean, I have best friends who I trust with everything and they trust me, and just thinking about them makes me feel like life is worth it. And I mean, does it get much truer than that?
There's a lot of love in friendship that I think it's easy to take for granted.
Yeah, I don't think that we put enough emphasis on platonic relationships or the relationships we have with family, friends, mentors, etc. There's all these different kinds of love. And we tend to, because we're people, I guess, want to partition them out and put different labels on them and say, this is the one that matters. This is the one that you need for, I don't know, a better job or like to make life easier. And these are the people who you get drinks with. But I tend to think of it all as just one sort of energy that gets applied in different ways. And when I think of it like that, it makes me feel like I'm not missing something just because I don't have a boyfriend or a romantic partner.
So when you have that friend group, there's a lot that you can accomplish that you just can't do by yourself, because everybody has some complimentary thing that they bring to with their affection for each other.
Yeah.
In your party of friends, are mm-hmm. you the Red 13? Are you the Cloud? Like, what character are you?
I'm sure everyone would have a different answer. Because with some people, you know, it's like, what's so crazy about us as people and individuals and this weird reality we're in is that we can sort of become different people depending on who we're with, and the dynamic itself can change us. So, well, I would see myself as the heiress. I see myself as, like, the healer. I'm sure there are people out there, be they friend or foe, who would have a very different opinion. And I'm sure I would have a different opinion on who they would be in that party.
This is possibly a very fun or also possibly very dangerous game to play with your mm-hmm. friends. Like,
oh, yeah.
To hear, like, if they're like, oh, no, you're the... Like, if somebody was like, no, you're the Cid.
I mean, yeah, we do that all the time with, like, the Real Housewives and with mm-hmm. the Gilmore Girls and with the Golden Girls. Like, who are you? Which one are you? And it's one of my favorite fights to have with people because it sort of reveals this deeply interior thing that sort of says, yes, this person has put a lot of heavy thought into who you are, which is nuts and flattering, right? Like, for them to be able to say, oh, you're a Samantha. I mean, that's such a flippant thing, but that sort of lets you know, wow, they have their own synthesis and analysis of your personality. You're in their head. That's nuts.
So who do you hope that people identify you as?
Within Final Fantasy VII?
Or within any fictional, like within the Golden
Girls. I was about to say, I want to be fucking Sephiroth in Final Fantasy VII. I want to be the Harbinger. That would be great. No one sees me that way. I'm sure they would see me as that weird one. How do you say it? It's like Ketsi or whatever. Ketsi, I don't know how to pronounce it. It's the cat piloting the giant mm-hmm. furry monster thing. Yeah.
No, I have a very close identification with Moogle, so that is totally...
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah, exactly. He's cute.
So I just have to point out, and spoiler alerts to people who haven't played Final Fantasy in the last, I don't know what, 20 years, Sephiroth is the character who kills Aerith?
Yes, absolutely.
So, I don't know. There might be something to... I don't know what the relationship is between those two characters for you personally, but it's interesting to me that on one hand you are like, yes, I'm this character, but I'm also this character that killed that character.
Yeah, so I'm fascinated with him because he's more of a vessel than any of the rest of them. So he sort of puts what his mission in life is ahead of his own body, his own life, ahead of everything, which is admirable in some ways. He just goes about it in this really fucked up way. But he believes that he's been put on Earth to do this one thing. Everything else is sort of a distraction. He's extremely skilled. He's extremely strong. But those are just means to an end for him. It's not like he gets any pleasure or pride out of it, which is something that's kind of badass to think about.
Do you think of yourself as Sephiroth in that you would do things differently?
Differently how?
You know, it sounds like you have a lot of admiration for him, believing in a higher cause.
Yeah.
But his approach of, basically going insane and becoming a murderous thing that wants to destroy everything.
Totally.
is perhaps a bit much.
Yes, to some tastes, it might be off-putting. Yeah, like, he sort of takes it to this place that it doesn't need to go. But at the same time, I guess I should say, I like his motifs. Him as, like, an actual person, he's clearly, like, a piece of shit. But at the same time, he's fascinating.
Well, not beyond redemption, right?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, he turns into this giant one-winged bird alien monster at the end and tries to kill everyone. But, I mean, who among us, if not given the chance? No.
It sounds like you're ready to forgive him.
Now that I think about it, one of the most horrifying things in the fourth grade was the moment where he stabbed Aerith through the chest. That was that was quite the death drop on that game. It's just like she's just sitting there and he comes from the sky and giant sword thing just sticks right through her. That was nuts. I remember I watched that with my dad and he was like, oh.
That is a moment, like, even today when I think about it, I can't breathe for a moment.
Right? It's just so much. It's very dramatic because she's sitting there in that water and she's praying and you don't know it, but that was actually the moment she saved the Earth. If she had been, like, a few seconds late on that, who knows what would have happened in that game world. I just sat there for a while and I looked at my dad like, oh my God, what?
Was that something that he explained to you?
He explained that he was really pissed off because, so what's funny is that my heterosexual white father really loved playing as her because she had this move called Seal Evil that would freeze the enemies so that they couldn't do anything. It was her limit break. So he was like, well, damn it. Now what am I going to do?
Yeah, you got to figure out how to move on from a trauma.
You have to, you know? But it's funny because we kept thinking she would come back. Like, the whole time we were playing, we were like, she's not really dead. She'll be back. There's no way they actually got rid of her. But in fact, you know, it's sure she comes back as, like, a memory thing and as a life force, but she never actually comes back. And that was, like, a really early introduction, I guess, to loss in a little micro way.
Yeah, yeah. It forces you to move on from someone who's supposed to be there to look after everybody.
Yeah, man, like I okay, played well. As her, and then she's gone. Like, the game itself does not let you play as her anymore. And that sort of finality of, like, you really can't play as her anymore? Am I not the player? Do I not have control over that? And you don't, turns out. And, you know, that's life.
Yeah, you gotta look after yourself.
Yeah, exactly. The game itself is not gonna spare you.
Well, so if people want to find your work, where should they go and how should they connect with you online?
You know, I have my Twitter. It's at JP Brammer, JPBRAMMER. And the name of my column is Hola Papi. It's on intomore.com, intomore.com.
Perfect. Well, thanks again so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It was such a good conversation.
Thanks again to JP for joining me. Check out his column at intomore.com. And for my recommendation this week, pick up the Dr. Seuss book I Had Trouble in Getting to Sala Salu. It's a quick read, of course, and it's about a young person, or cat, or dog, or whatever Dr. Seuss creatures are, who's beset by troubles and does everything he can to escape from them. On his way to a promised paradise called Sala Salu, he endures bad weather, illness, war, canceled bus routes. Nothing goes his way, and the closer he gets to his destination, the rougher life becomes. But he's determined to make it, because he's convinced all his troubles will be over if he can just get far enough away from them. And maybe that would work, if only Sala Salu was a little more accessible. Turns out, there's no such thing as a place that's trouble-free, no matter how far you travel, and that leaves our hero with a choice. To keep running from his troubles, or turn back and deal with them, knowing now that troubles never really go away, but you can become trouble for them. Thanks again for listening. And just a reminder, I've got a live show coming up where drag queens play D&D on stage. It's at Oasis in San Francisco on March 20th. Come see Erica Clash, Kitty Powers, Poya Del Mar, and Kai Kai B. Michaels on a legendary journey with a special appearance by the delightful Pup Amp. Tickets are now on sale at dungeondrag.com. And if you're not in San Francisco, I hope you'll pass the word along to anyone who you think might enjoy the show. And we're currently crowdfunding to make a podcast with drag queens playing D&D. If you've enjoyed the bonus episodes of The Sewers of Paris with Dungeons & Dragons, head over to queensofadventure.com to check out the show and the rewards available to backers. Visit sewersofparis.com to watch clips of some of the stuff we talked about and to become a part of the Sewers family by supporting the show for as little as $1 a month. Huge thanks to everyone who keeps the podcast going. Let me know your thoughts via Sewers of Paris on Twitter and Facebook. Also leave a review on the podcast platform of choice. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.